Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, a Bulwark contributor, and counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you in this post-holiday environment?
Well, I'm about 5 pounds heavier, Eric. But, you know, that's the price you pay. And actually, it was kind of a pleasant way to put them on. We had all the whole family, including all the grandchildren with us. And it was delightful, but somewhat exhausting. But we are back at work on Shield of the Republic. We should begin, I think, with our opening segment. And I think I forewarned you a while back that although I will normally recount with glee the jackasseries of the week, I will periodically throw down a Trump card. And this week I'm going to throw down two. The first is I really think Trump deserves a lot of credit for the Gaza ceasefire and the return of the living hostages. And I say that fully understanding all the ways in which this could go south, it's incomplete, and so on and so forth. He literally rescued 20 human beings from the underworld. And, you know, having just got back from Israel a couple of weeks ago, I have to tell you, most of the senior people that I spoke with then, frankly, did not expect that those hostages were going to come back alive. And, you know, the joy is, you know, it really is remarkable. It's that country is like one big family and actually extends to the Jewish world beyond. So I do give him credit for that. The other thing which got a bit less attention was a story in the Financial Times that the United States is providing exquisite targeting information to the Ukrainians for the attacks on the Russian oil refining system. And that too, you know, that's the kind of thing that frankly Joe Biden never did, never would have done. It's the right thing to do. I hope it's followed on by waves of tomahawks. Now, that, of course, the downside in all this is that Trump's now decided he wants to go meet with Putin in Budapest. So I'm trying to forestall your withering rebukes, but I guess I'm going to get them anyway. So
no. In the interest of time, because I want to get to our very special guest today, I am going to, you know, withhold the, you know, slings and arrows that normally I would throw your way for, you know, these concessions to Trump, in part because I don't disagree with what you said, but I would put more emphasis on the incompleteness and the potential reversibility of some of this. But I do want to draw attention to, you know, the continuing jackassery that goes on in, you know, one of my former institutions, the Pentagon, with the ridiculous press standards, alleged standards that the Secretary of Defense wants to impose, and the result that all of the Pentagon press corps, with I think the exception of one American network, have basically turned in their press credentials. I would point out too that there's a particular ugliness to all this, which is Hegseth's, you know, harping on Jennifer Griffin of Fox News and Courtney Kuby of NBC, both of whom I know from my time in the Pentagon, who were you know, among two of the more professional and better journalists covering the Pentagon. You know, Hegseth was a colleague of Jennifer's at Fox. It's totally uncalled for, and ultimately self-defeating and bad for the institution, because having vigorous press coverage, you know, always, in my view, as painful as it was sometimes, always made us a better institution. But speaking of institutions, we have someone who has spent his life studying American governing institutions. I'm happy to welcome to Shield of the Republic Bill Galston, who is no stranger to the Bulwark. He's a former panelist on Mona Charon's Beg to Differ show. He's a senior fellow and Ezra Zilka Chair of Governance Studies at Brookings, as well as a Wall Street Journal columnist. And for our purposes, he's the author of a new book, Anger, Fear, Domination, Dark Passions and the Power of Political Speech. Bill Galston, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Eric, Elliot, thanks so much for the invitation. Happy to be here.
So let me start off, and I know Elliot will jump in. What led you to write this book, and describe for our listeners and viewers what the dark passions that you outline in the book, you know, what are they specifically, and why do you believe that liberalism, lowercase liberalism, is particularly vulnerable to these dark passions today?
Well, let me begin, as I frequently do, with the Greeks, who had a triadic system to describe the human soul. They saw at one end of the continuum reason, our rational capacity. At the other end of the continuum, interest, self-interests, the basic self-interests springing from our embodiment, our bodily needs, for food, shelter, security, and a measure of prosperity, et cetera, et cetera. But in between them were the passions. And some of them I would describe as light passions, moving us towards our own good and also the good of those around us. And the others are dark passions, which can undermine communities and governments, but could also undermine the individuals who give way to them. And my observation about liberalism, which I've spent my life studying, is that it was born out of an effort to sideline and cabin the dark passions as much as possible. And it ended up either by forgetting about them or by believing that there were substitutes for them that could soften them or even nullify them. And so, Hobbes' view, just to start at the beginning, was that we could reason our way out of the impasse created by the dark passions. And that was, this rational arrangement, which would conduce to peace and prosperity, was something that we would all agree to if we understood our real situation, our vulnerability, our fear of death, et cetera, et cetera. But what began, so there were really three phases. That was phase number one, reason as an antidote to the passions. Phase number two, which was particularly prominent in the 18th century, but never disappeared entirely, was the idea that a focus on commerce, on the economy, would end up softening our souls and ultimately weakening the force of the dark passions to the extent that we could live peacefully, not only within countries, but also between countries. And that is the origin, actually, of the famous notion of the liberal peace. It ultimately goes back to this idea of a network of commercial relationships. In the book, I talk about one of my favorite examples of this, a fellow by the name of Norman Angell, a British pacifist of the late 19th and early 20th century, who in 1913 published a book called The Great Illusion, in which he argued that we need not worry about the outbreak of a European war because the dense network of commercial relationships that had grown up among European nations would make such a war irrational. And because it was irrational, it wouldn't happen. Classic liberal syllogism. If it's not reasonable, then people won't do it. But he forgot about something. The dark passions and what the combination of anger and fear can do to twist the outlook of leaders of countries, right? And I could go on at some length about how those passions can distort our perception of what we have to gain and what we have to lose. Okay, so that's phase two. Phase three, which I think sets in after World War II, is a simple forgetting of these passions and, you know, a mounting belief that human beings were basically good. If they're bad, it's because of social institutions. Who can forget the lyrics of West Side Story? We're depraved on account of we're deprived. But that's just a very popular expression of the idea that if our innate goodness is simply encouraged and allowed to flower in a decent society, that we can live peacefully together. And that's a long historical sequence, which leads up to the observation that typically liberals are blindsided by the rise of dark passions in politics. Where did that come from? We ask ourselves. And a little knowledge of history would answer that question. But an historical consciousness is not liberalism's strong suit. You know, liberals are looking forward. They're always looking forward with hope, at least until very recently. And, and so this process of forgetting goes in cycles, but it was particularly acute in the years after World War II, and especially after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union. At that point, it reigned triumphant.
So, you know, one of the things I really like about the book is it is in some ways a work of political philosophy. So Donald Trump, I think his first appearance is somewhere around page 106 or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. But it very much speaks to the current moment, although there are a lot of wonderful little things in it. You know, you mentioned Norman Angell. The thing that I hadn't really realized is that he kept on revising The Great Illusion even after World War One, believing the same claptrap all the way until he died sometime in the
19th. Oh, it gets better than that, Eliot. You know what year he actually won the Nobel Peace Prize for that book?
It was sometime in the 30s, right?
1933. So he publishes this book about the end of war in 1913. And then he's rewarded. You know, never was a book more fittingly, if ironically, titled. You know, talk about the great illusion. But we dined off that illusion.
But not to mention what that says about the Nobel Peace Prize. So
there's that too. So, but I guess here's the question that I have. I think to bring it to the current moment, we can all see how Trump is brilliant at playing on some of the dark passions of resentment and anger and so on and hatred. But. I think we're also at a moment where, if we're honest with ourselves, on both the right and the left, you see the dark passions fully unleashed. Now, if I understand you correctly, when you talk about liberals, you really do mean sort of the center, the great mushy center, which I guess in many ways all three of us are part of. And, I suppose the question is, do you really think that the left of the American political spectrum at the moment now is indeed liberal, and therefore, in the grip of the illusions that you talk about, or is it essentially illiberal? In other words, are we dealing with kind of two illiberal extremes, which together actually are a substantial portion of the population?
Well, first of all, this always happens in these discussions. The term liberal is two-faced, and many conservatives would say that liberals are two-faced, but that's a different subject altogether. One of these faces is philosophical. And so when we talk about liberal democracy, that's not the antonym of conservative democracy. It's the antonym of illiberal or total democracy, the sort of thing that we're seeing in Hungary and other places who try to imitate Viktor Orban. And then there's the political face of the term liberal, which is situated obviously between, conservative on the one hand and left progressive on the other. Are there portions of the left that are illiberal? You bet there are. And they're not as big, I believe, at this point as the portions of the right that have been mobilized into illiberalism. But I sat down about a month ago and read the charter of the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, who are about to have a representative in, you know, Gracie Mansion in New York City. And it is a profoundly illiberal document. And I worked through some of the details in my column, and I was amazed at how close to, you know, I wouldn't say a communist, but a certainly hardline socialist document it is. It's well to the left of the socialist platform that brought, you know, Clement Attlee and labor to power in just a couple of months after the end of World War II. And, you know, regrettably, if you look at the, you know, the emanations of that attitude in some college campuses, one would be hard put to say that the spirit and the letter of our constitutional commitment to free speech had been honored in those places. There was a lot of suppression of speech, or at least intimidation, to make sure that people who were thinking of dissenting from orthodoxy would think twice. And I have to say, I'm not just learning about this from newspapers. I heard reports, you know, horrifying stories from academic colleagues and friends of mine, you know, about the treatment to which they were subjected if they even used an unwise word. I'm not going to go into details because this episode would be identifiable, but somebody accidentally added the two letters ED, you know, to a standard term for people who change from one gender to the other. And he was, you know, the dean summoned him for a dressing down. He was ordered to apologize. You know, other friends of mine were told that they could no longer teach courses in African-American history or African-American culture because they weren't of the right hue to teach such courses. It goes on and on and on. So when some people on the right complain about illiberalism on the left, they're not talking about nothing, right? However, as a statistical matter, the size of illiberalism on the right end of the American political spectrum is much greater than it is on the left, where it is no more, generously speaking, than 10%. It's some multiple of that on the right.
Can I just ask one quick follow-up and then hand it back? Eric, I mean, you know, like, and I think we should point out you had a very distinguished academic career at University of Texas and the University of Maryland, where you were, for your sins, a dean as well as a professor.
Boy, you said that right. Never.
Well, I know the pain. And, you know, I guess for me, as I try to think my way through the current moment where I really feel politically totally homeless, one question I have in my mind is where is that illiberalism most deeply rooted? Or that is to say, you know, which of the two extremes can I imagine sort of drifting back into something like what the three of us would probably prefer to think of as normalcy, where we might have, you know, vigorous disagreements about how much the government should do in terms of healthcare, let's say. But you know, the fundamental issues of free speech, and, you know, that all those sorts of things would be totally unquestioned. And there's a part of me which worries that actually the illiberalism on the left is more deeply rooted. I mean, that's a tentative judgment. It's not a conclusion I've come to. I'm just wondering if you have a take on that, or do you think they're both equally deeply rooted?
It's hard to make a judgment about that. But I will say this. there was a fair fight in 2024 between a sort of a classic Reagan Republican and the inventor of the MAGA movement. And the result was a 4-1 victory for the latter over the former. I mean, Nikki Haley was a perfectly competent candidate, more than competent. I actually thought she might have been a decent president. I wouldn't have voted for her, but I wouldn't have wept bitterly if she'd won the election, in the same way that I didn't vote for George H.W. Bush in 1988, but I didn't tremble for the future of the Republic when he won. Compare that to the Democratic Party right now, where I think the odds are that, you know, a what I'll call a traditional liberal candidate, one of the governors, is, you know, will be the nominee. And obviously, if you're a governor in a blue state, you have to bow more in the direction of the progressive left than you do if you're the governor of a purple state like Pennsylvania or like Virginia, assuming the outcome of the Virginia election. So I think the forces, at least right now, if I have to make a political judgment, are much more evenly divided on the Democratic side than they are on the Republican side. Now, you may say in reply, well, I've sort of slipped the punch because I've talked about the political balance of forces, but you were asking about deeply rooted. And there I would say there are deep intellectual roots of illiberalism on both the left end and the right end of the political spectrum, just looking across the West. And broadly speaking, that is true in the United States. You know, very eminent scholars have long asked the question, why is there no, you know, real socialism in the United States? Why hasn't there been? You know, my old friend Seymour Martin Lipset talked about that question endlessly. And in Europe, I would have to say the illiberal left has much deeper historical roots than it does in the United States. I'm not so sure I would say the same thing about the illiberal right, you know, because we have our own illiberal tradition that goes back to our founding and original sin, which induced, you know, all manner of illiberalisms as a way of justifying the existence of slavery. I mean, and there's a long tradition of which John C. Calhoun and lots of others, you know, are representatives. You know, a professor of mine at the University of Chicago, Herbert Storing of blessed memory, taught an entire course about this. And so if I had to make a judgment, you know, as between hardline socialism and, you know, and native grown illiberalism, which is stronger in the United States, I would say the latter, not the former. Can't prove it, but you asked, so I answered.
I don't want to go down this particular rabbit hole, although we could do probably a whole show on this. But I mean, it does strike me, Bill, that that what you describe about the DSA is in some sense a fundamental repudiation of its own founding. I mean, Michael Harrington, who was one of the founders of the DSA, wrote a book towards the Democratic left, which was trying to essentially, you know, maintain the elements of liberal democracy with socialism as a kind of true social democrat. And I gather that at some of the recent meetings, Harrington's name is like a dirty word in the DSA. People want to de-Harringtonize the DSA to make it, you know, this horrible leftist.
You take it right. And actually, an acquaintance of mine who resigned from the DSA after being a member for 49 years, you know, explained to me that in the wake of the, you know, of the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, there was a concerted effort on the part of the hard left to enter, infiltrate, take over the DSA. And so in the past 10 years, it has been transformed from its its founding purpose and orientation into something very, very different and scary, frankly. And it combines, you know, it combines the worst of hard-edged socialism with the worst of hard-edged anti-colonial thinking. You know, either one is enough to create a toxic brew. You put them together and it is lethal, at least lethal to any reasonable outlook on the world. And I was astounded when I actually sat down and read their charter, which is, you know, unabashedly explicit about all of these commitments. I have to say, you know, to be sort of historically scrupulous, the guy who's likely to be the next mayor of New York City was the keynote speaker at the National DSA convention less than 2 years ago. And if there was any daylight between his audience and himself, it was very hard to discern.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to throw in an anecdote here, which is this past summer, my wife and I were in the Smokies going on a family vacation. We were staying in Gatlinburg, which is sort of the entry city to go to the Smokies. And we're walking down the street and, you know, there's the Trump merch stores and the places that are selling alligator and turkey jerky and the Ripley's Believe It or Not and the, you know, the storefront churches and all that. And but, you know, people are very nice and friendly. And, you know, my wife says to me, yeah, I know what you're thinking. But honestly, who's more our people, these folks or Zoran Mamdani? And there was no question in my mind what the answer was.
Well, I've made it my life's work as a political matter to ensure that there is a Democratic Party like people that people like, you know, the two moderators on this show could consider as a safety valve, you know, if things went to hell, you know, on native ground. And we had some success in the late 80s and the 90s, at least from my point of view. Now, I was a little bit too close to that to deliver an objective judgment, but I think it's fair to say that the peace and prosperity of the 90s were pretty good, and the level of civic disagreement, although rising, was far from intolerable during that period. It's the 21st century that has witnessed a series of blows to our national equanimity.
Can we get back to that, do you think?
Yeah, I'd like to get back to that before we end, but I do want to take this in a slightly different direction for a moment, Bill, which is one of the more arresting lines in the book is you say the task of politics in dark times is to transform hope into confidence, and you talk about different kinds of persuasion, and you talk about the decline of character and authority as sources of persuasion. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you think people can be persuaded out of this illiberal moment? What, you know, what does that take? Because there's an active debate right now in the Democratic Party about, you know, what that is. The brand is so toxic. Is it abundance or is it some other discourse that will allow the Democrats to, you know, do more than just, you know, oppose Trump? Although I would point out that, you know, mere opposition can get you pretty far in American politics. If you think about the Whig Party, for instance, which, you know, essentially was created and existed on the basis of opposition to Andrew Jackson.
One of the purposes of my book is to restore the centrality of speech to our understanding of politics. And I do a little bit of that in theory, going back to the Greeks, talking about some of Plato's dialogues, etc. But my real focus was on the past century or century and a half of American political history. And I talk about presidents who changed history through the power of their rhetoric. And one moment on which I focus at some length, was the country that FDR inherited when, you know, he took office in March of 1933. And it was a desperate country. It was a country that could have gone in a number of different regime directions as nations with economic and social woes across Europe were already doing. And when he sized up the mood of the country, fear, you know, paralyzing fear, you know, his lead was the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. He spoke directly to that mood and took the first step, you know, to translating pervasive national fear into renewed confidence. And if you look at that speech, you know, it is a sustained effort to tell his fellow Americans, look, we have a lot going for us. You know, one line that I particularly remember from that speech is that, you know, our troubles, thank God, concern only material things. That is to say, our institutions are sound. Our culture is sound. Our economy is on the rocks for now, but there are things we can do starting today to turn that around. Now, obviously, and that speech was a jolt of electricity, right? This, you know, the country had only recently become electrified and only very recently, you know, was radio penetration as, you know, as total as television penetration was a generation later. But people were gathered around their radios all across the country to hear that speech. It had a tremendous impact. And then, of course, when it was followed up by emergency action, like restoring the soundness of the financial system with a series of bold, successful strokes, people began to believe it. And they began to believe more in themselves. Now, the times we face now are very different. But I don't think we should underestimate the power, the potential power, at least, of a message suited to the mood of the moment that could gain a strong following. And let me just offer a speculation. As I read the public mood, at least in the vast center of the electorate, and there still is a vast center of the American electorate. Let's not lose sight of that. You know, people who are neither MAGA nor DSA, that is still a majority of the country. I'd say the majority of that majority is fed up with endless political warfare. They're exhausted by it. They have come to realize that it is the enemy of all progress in any direction. It's like a giant tug, you know, a tug of war. You know, an enormous amount of energy is being exerted at both ends of the rope, but the rope isn't moving, right? That's not where people want to be. And I think that they would accept reasonable compromises. Compromises that would offend the basis of both political parties, but would not offend the sensibilities of the vast American center. I think they'd accept that if they thought they would get in return some civil peace and a modicum of progress, you know, to deal with problems that have been stuck for a very long time, particularly in the economy. So what about, dare I say it, a peacemaker message for the next American president? I know that's a radical thought, particularly in the current climate of pitched warfare, but we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that this pitched warfare represents the views of the people who have been forced to divide themselves into opposing camps, forced not by their own sentiments, but by the paucity of choices. So I'm sounding a little bit more hopeful than maybe I am, but I will say this. You know, I saw, and to some extent was part of, a moment in which one of America's two major political parties, which had lost touch with the electorate and lost three consecutive national elections, lost control of the narrative, lost control of public policy, was transformed into a party that a majority of the American people were comfortable voting for. Now, can history repeat itself? No, but as the familiar saw goes, it can rhyme. And I'm committed to the idea that in the next 3 years, the Democrats can do what they did in the late 80s and early 90s. Is the game plan there? No. But by analogy, we are now in October of 1989. Where were Democrats as a party in October of 1989? At sixes and sevens, the party was reeling. Three consecutive national defeats. You know, 1984, I was Fritz Mondale's policy director for 2.5 years. And I can tell you that, you know, by June of that year, you know, it was, you know, especially after Reagan's famous plant, these are the boys of Plant de Hoc speech. I mean, you had to be blind to the situation to believe that Reagan wasn't going to be reelected. But to lose to George H.W. Bush, not Mr. Charisma, you know, when it's so very difficult, as American history teaches us, for a sitting vice president to replace an incumbent president of his party after two consecutive terms, hardly ever happens. But it happened. And it was at that point that, you know, Democrats who weren't in denial said, hey, you know, we have been sent a message, and we can either choose to ignore it or respond to it. But standing pat is really not an option. So could it happen again? Yes, I firmly believe that.
Yeah, I think it was Bush 41 and Martin Van Buren, and Van Buren was also a one-term president.
Okay, so. Well, to have the same political party in charge for 12 years is a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a comment and a question for you. The comment is, think about that very good point about the Roosevelt speech, where he did say our institutions are fine, our culture is fine. Unfortunately, you'd have to have, to be truthful, the speech today would, I think, have to be the reverse, saying the economy isn't actually not doing so badly in many ways, but our culture and our institutions are in grave shape. And, you know, those are harder things to fix, unfortunately, I think, my view, than the economy. I don't know if you would agree with it or not. The question in a way follows upon the discussion about American history that we've just had. And I know you don't quite agree with my characterizations, which is why I'd like to hear what you have to say about it. It does seem to me that the people who frame the current moment in the United States largely in terms of American history and the kinds of things we've been through in the past and just the way the country works tend to be, let's say, slightly less pessimistic, if not indeed more optimistic, than those who particularly sort of comparative political scientists, you know, who all of us know, who are saying, well, you know, there are the 17 indications of incipient fascism, and, you know, we've now hit 15, and there's only two more left, and that, you know, then it's we'll be in full Mussolini,
or former U.S. ambassadors to Turkey,
right. So I mean, you can tell which side I'm on and which side Eric is on. Like I said, I'm not sure you entirely agree with that typology, but I would just be curious how you react to that and how you think about this and what weight you give to the patterns of the American past as opposed to the kind of more general phenomenon, which we're unquestionably seeing.
Good, tough question. I was on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy for 9 years. You know, I joined the board at the beginning of 2006, you know, and I was Hegel's classic owl of Minerva because, you know, I arrived, you know, after 3 decades of democratic progress, you know, starting with, you know, the famous revolutions on the Iberian Peninsula and moving on through Europe, the fall of the wall. Democracy peaked in 2006. And its decline has been documented by every credible international organization, you know, with a rigorous methodology. You know, Freedom House, you know, the VDEM folks in Scandinavia, et cetera. The democratic decline is real, and the United States has not been exempt from it, right? So there are indeed strong indicators that democracy in America is weaker than it was. And if we keep on going down this path indefinitely, we could at some point forfeit the honorific title of democracy. Will we continue to go down this path? I don't know. Are the pessimists making up the bad news? No, they are not, right? They're looking at very real forces and trends in American society. The question is whether what's left of our institutions is strong enough to halt the retreat and then form the basis for a new policy of democratic reconstruction. I think I can say with some confidence that going back to the way things were before the wrecking ball hit is not an option. And it may not be entirely bad either. We may have an opportunity to rebuild institutions for the 21st century that are more fit for purpose, as the Brits would say, than the ones that were knocked down. And let's take the wrecking ball applied to the bureaucracy. I have to say that my own political party, I believe, got pretty complacent about the status quo. And at one point during the administration that I served, the Clinton administration, the idea of reform, you know, as an alternative to both just, you know, preserving the status quo on the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, attacking the deep state frontally. That was a very shrewd strategy. And by the way, it had the effect during those 8 years of shrinking the federal bureaucracy more than Donald Trump was going to be able to. That's, you know, that's just a statistical fact. So, you know, and Democrats forgot about the imperative of reform, and with regard to many institutions became a status quo party, confronting an electorate that was increasingly discontented with the status quo. You know, if you want my analysis of what happened in 2024, you had a candidate of change versus a candidate of the status quo at a time when the American people were intensely dissatisfied with many aspects of the status quo. And so, you know, they leapt into change that they didn't fully understand or didn't fully subscribe to when they did understand it, because the alternative seemed to them in those circumstances to be worse. Some of them are now revisiting that decision that they made. And I think that politically, Trump is a lot weaker than he was in November of 2024. And I can prove that, you know, with survey data, but we don't have any time to do that. Besides, that's not what this show is about. So here's what I would say. You know, to bring it to a head. If the integrity of our elections is preserved and the rule of law is preserved, we will survive this as a functioning democracy. If the president of the United States, faced with a negative judgment by the Supreme Court on, let us say, the suit challenging the use of the International Emergencies Economic Powers Act to impose global tariffs, the core of his economic strategy, I'd say there's at least a 50% chance that the Supreme Court is going to say that he exceeded his writ when he did that. There is a reason why Congress, which listed 11 things that could be done pursuant to IEPA, did not include tariffs among them. And so if the court is true to you know, its method of reading laws that's now fundamental to its alleged jurisprudential doctrine stays true to that. Okay, all that is an extended way of asking the question, what will the president of the United States do if he's confronted with that judgment from the court? If he accedes to it, a lot of his program will have to be revised fundamentally, but an important part of American democracy will have been preserved. If, on the other hand, you know, he says what Andrew Jackson is alleged to have said, but did not really, namely John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. If he says some version of that, then we have a constitutional crisis. Similarly, if we have a free and fair election in 2026, if we don't have National Guardsmen intimidating people at polling places, you know, and if the rules of the game haven't been changed so fundamentally that, you know, an election may be free, but it's no longer fair, or perhaps neither free nor fair, with one extreme formulation of what could happen, then once again, we have a true democratic crisis. I think we're going to know a lot more about this question by the end of 2006 than we do now, as the end of 2005 is nearing.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. I mean, that's a unusually hopeful note for Shield of the Republic to end on, but we'll take it. And I hope we can have you back either when you've written your next book or before, depending on the course of events. But well,
given how long it takes me to write my books, I would urge you to go down the second course, because I've enjoyed this conversation a lot. I'd be happy to come back and spend an hour with you anytime.
Thank you, Bill.